Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Kristen and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 174 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell, and alongside me, Johnny Stofko.
What's up, everybody? What's up, TK? 174, man. 174, not 74.
Yeah, it's nearly 2 years, my man.
That's crazy. We're approaching our two-year anniversary, man. How awesome is that?
It's pretty cool.
Still learning.
Start at the bottom, and
we're still at the bottom. That should be our slogan. Yeah. Start at the bottom, and we're still at the bottom.
We're incredible people, aren't we?
Yeah, think about the conversations we've had, what we're learning, our skill sets individually from when you and I met at our gym at George Street. And I remember I was already coaching there. You're walking down the stairs, and it was like one of your first days, and you had your laptop. And at the time, guys, nobody was walking around George Street, let alone with like a physical program guide. But like you had the laptop, you had the book, and I was like, look at this guy. And you had the website up, you had a cookbook up already, and to see where you were there and compared to where you are now and then where our show is going, it's a cool thing, man.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an emerging thing.
So yeah.
I think we've both grown a lot since then.
Oh, for sure, man.
Good, but it's all part and parcel of being around with some great people. And thank you to the 174 people that have been on the Vision More podcast, because we couldn't do it without you.
Yeah, man. Who do we got today? Who are we bringing to the table?
Phil White. I'm really excited about this one. You know, we're both very interested in reading books and authors and things like that. And this guy really connects the dots with some of our past guests in terms of Brian McKenzie and Andy Galpin.
Dr. Andy Galpin was recently on, guys. Professor at Cal State Fullerton, researcher. He's on the forefront right now of sports performance with combat athletes, works well close with the UFC. And our boy Brian McKenzie, the art of breathing, ultra endurance athlete. Phil White, guys, is the, what would you call him? I don't want to call him the puppeteer of the books, but he's kind of like the filter.
He's the master.
He's the master.
He puts the story together. He's the one that, as he will explain, like, I didn't know how a book process works, which he will explain in terms of how they
the structure, the editing,
which is quite interesting. And he's got a new book, actually, with Game Changer with Fergus Connolly. And Fergus Connolly, Michigan strength and conditioning coach.
So Jim Harbaugh did the forwarding, right?
He did.
On Game Changer.
So, you know, in terms of in the strength and conditioning field, I'm sure that all the coaches and people interested in that aspect will know exactly who Fergus is. And
yep.
It's an interesting kind of crowd, because this all started with Kelly Starrett as well. So
connecting those dots too, from our guest perspective, but also from our individual perspective. And guys listening, if whatever industry you're in or whatever your passion is, never undervalue or underestimate the importance of building a network, building a positive network, surrounding yourselves around people that you could learn from, but not necessarily expect anything in return. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important thing too, to sit in a space with somebody that you feel is at a level that you're not quite there yet, and just listen.
I think so. And be prepared to do something for them as well. I think that's a huge one. Just don't, like, I know there's a lot of advice around there that surround yourself with great people, but you need to be doing something in return for them, because why should you be in their presence?
Right. Whether it's doing something specifically to enable them or doing something for yourself.
It could be promoting them on the outside on social media. It could be something simple.
Or developing your own skill set so you could be a benefit for them down the road too.
Yeah.
So if you've got nothing
to give someone.
Yeah.
Every day on your Facebook, promote something that, just say it's me and you, right?
Yep.
And you give me something.
For sure.
I should be on my Facebook every day promote. If I've got nothing else to give you back in return, which can happen depending on experience level, age, where we are in
connection,
life.
Network. Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you introduce me to someone, do something nice in return. When something, and
that's a huge
something
point.
That I've always kind of just wanted to go by, is someone does me a favor, it might be me introducing them to someone. It might be me writing something nice about them on a Facebook, writing an article about them, or even buying them dinner.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be simple.
Just having conversations. That's an important bit. I think that goes in line with being selfless as well. You know, it's really tough for people. You know, we're not trying to rewire anyone's mental conditioning here, but we're speaking from experience of those reposts and those tags of, like, you look at Phil White, our upcoming guest, his social medias, you know, he's not a big believer of needing to be social media famous sort of thing.
Yeah.
And he'll go into the conversation about, because of his body of work, because of his credibility and his network, he'd rather promote his friends.
Yeah.
And
it's incredible.
It is an incredible thing. And he's very open about that. And it's kind of making me look at the whole landscape of social media a little bit differently. When you're looking at the people on the forefront, whether it's business, entrepreneur, sports, are they really promoting anyone else other than themselves? And you know, how it's a rare thing then to actually see a guy who's as credible as Phil White promoting other people. He talks about Kelly quite often. Yeah. You know, it comes down to being gratitude, too, is really important.
Yeah, I think he's grateful to actually know the guys, and I'm sure the guys are very grateful to know him as well because it's a two-way street. But, yeah, I think we've touched on that pretty well. I think, yeah, it's just that kind of two-way street of
giving, taking. Give, take.
Not just give, or take.
It's that sweet spot. Kind
of that sweet spot between both, and I think if you can find that formula for yourself, that's when the magic happens,
right? Yes, man. I couldn't say it better, Tristan Cannell.
All right, guys, before we get Phil on the show, just a big shout-out to everyone subscribing. There has been a lot of new thingos on iTunes.
The downloads, reviews, subscriptions? So,
yes.
Those are the ones we need.
So they're all up. Huge. So if you haven't yet, please hit that subscription button. It's free. And also just search Vision Board Podcast on your iTunes app or your iTunes desktop thing, and you can leave a review. It's pretty simple.
Yeah, guys, really, that really helps us out. I was, before we get Phil on the show, I was going through the podcast app for the first time in a while, and they have this feature. I don't know if it's old or new, but I never seen it. What your listeners also listen to. Mm-hmm. And did you see who were, like, it's us, and then you see, like, Joe DeFranco, Jason Ferrugia,
Zach.
What a cool thing, man. I thought that was really rad. I never seen that before.
Yeah, it's good. It's like a related, I think they call it or something.
Yeah, and it all comes down to you guys listening. So we can't, say enough how much we appreciate you guys. And, keep feeding us the good feedback, and we'll keep bringing it for you.
Absolutely. So, guys, I introduce Phil White. Our special guest is Phil White. Phil is an Emmy-nominated writer and the co-author of The Game Changer with Fergus Connolly. He's also a co-author of Unplugged with Andy Galpin and Brian McKenzie. Other books, The 17-Hour Fast with Dr. Frank Merritt. When not writing about himself in the third person, he enjoys walks in the woods with his wife and two sons. He loves his stand-up paddleboarding and also a nice glass of stout. Welcome, Phil White. Phil, welcome to the podcast, buddy.
Raise a glass of stout to you, my friends.
Yes, sir. Phil White, like Tristan said, the credentials, the writing, the books, your circle, your network as well is very, admirable. I want to start the show off with kind of, from your first person sense to our people listening and the fans of the Vision Board, kind of share a little bit about when you are putting these books together or asked to come on board to put your two cents in. What your strengths are and what you're trying to accomplish specifically with the last few books.
Sure. Well, I think I share my co-author's passion for helping people improve their lives. Mm. And if what you're doing comes from a pure motivation like that and a set of core values, then hopefully the end product reflects that. And if we move the needle 1 degree for one person, then I feel like each of these books is a success. And then also I really view it from a servant leadership standpoint where all these co-authors, whether it be Kelly Starrett or it's Andy Galpin or Brian McKenzie or whoever, have all these great ideas in their heads, and they're often very good at verbalizing. They're teachers at heart, right? They have their seminars and they have their daily videos and this type of thing. So they're great at verbalizing it, but maybe they don't either have the time or the inclination to write. And so that's where I come in. So we really just, it's a pretty simple process at this time. We got it down where we come up with a table of contents. Yep. And once we have that list of chapters, we just schedule a series of conversations and move from chapter one to chapter 9 or 10 to the end. And a manuscript comes at the end. They make their edits and then bang, we send it to the publisher and there you go. So yeah, really just trying to serve them as best I can and getting all those brilliant ideas onto the page.
Yeah.
So you're telling me, so I have a course and I teach it, I present it in a public speaking format, and doing it in a book format is the bit that I want to achieve, but kind of like lost on a systematic approach. You know, there's really no one raising their hand like, Johnny, I'll go this route, or there's this business out there that will take these ideas and put it on paper. Is this sort of what you do, or did Andy find you? Did Brian find you, or did you find them?
Sure. So yeah, really, it all comes back to Kelly. So when I was given the kind of health and fitness beat for Sup the Mag when it started, so this is the companion magazine to Surfer Magazine, the OG, right, the original for water sports, and also came out of some editors who wrote Canoe and Kayak as well. And so they sent some of their best people and said, go start a stand-up paddleboarding mag, and really felt they were starting from ground zero, health and fitness. And so I had jacked up my back deadlifting a few years back and really needed a non-surgical, non-pharmaceutical way to solve this. You know, I was having nerve pain in places where you don't want nerve pain, you know, and thought I would never be pain-free. Yeah. So I did some research online, came across Kelly back when he was in what he calls the parking lot of dreams at San Francisco CrossFit. Yeah. I mean, I think they were in the top 10 or 12, first 10 or 12 CrossFit gyms in the world. And it was the old grainy video with the flip phone. And so just did some of that, of his exercises for a couple of weeks. And it's like, oh, bang, no more pain, no more nerve pain. So I just reached out to him and just said, mate, you know, I'm writing for this magazine. I know you have a water sports background. Would you be willing to do, say, the top 5 shoulder mobility exercises for paddlers? So he did a video for us. We ended up talking again a few weeks later. We did another article together, and we just really, he was bouncing around the idea of doing, you've seen his Ready to Run book, that kind of idea for paddlers and surfers. So anyone's in the water sports, which obviously with you guys down there with the Nippers and yeah. Waterman culture is really strong in Australia, and Kelly came from a background of being a river guide. He lived in his van with his dog when he was a rafting guide for a couple of years, and he was also on the national whitewater slalom team. And so really we decided, look, if you're going to be on the water, you should have these basic movement competencies, and if you don't, here are some exercises to fix them. So that book should be out next year. And then we've done another one called Flight Plan, which is basically a 12-step protocol for flying. And Kelly, being the great connector, put me in touch with Brian McKenzie. And that's really how Unplugged came about. And Brian and Andy have been talking about, you know, fitness technology kind of unbound. And you see people walking around with this social signifier of, I'm fit, because I have something that part of the name is fit on me, you know. And obviously, we've got gone way beyond the HR chest straps. HRV is now like the golden thing, you know. Well, if your HRV number's in the toilet, you better not train. And so we set out to investigate, is that really true? Is this stuff accurate? And how can we draw some better boundaries for using it?
Yeah, Phil, in your role as a co-author, are the boys literally sending you a whole heap of information, and then you're breaking this down to make it readable and put it into proper content and structure? Is that essentially how it works?
No, it's conversations, mate, largely. So, like I said, we agree on a table of content, say 7 to 10 chapters, and then come up with maybe 5 to 7 main talking points for each one. And then I just email them, all right, Brian, tomorrow's call, we're going to be talking about points 1 through 3 in chapter 1, which are as follows.
Yep.
So when we get on the call, he's got some notes, and then I'll go and have the same conversation with Andy in this case, where there were 3 of us, and then I'll go away and write it up. They'll be texting me and emailing me links, and I'll be finding research to supplement what they say. But largely, it's the conversations that are driving the final product, which I think is why you hear their voice coming through. Like the book, like Game Changer, where my co-author Fergus Connolly, who... he's worked with everyone from Clarko in Aussie Rules, you know, Clarko's Cluster, that whole thing, like that kind of tactical revolution.
Yeah,
to the NBA, to the Welsh National Rugby team, and now with Jim Harbaugh at Michigan football in college football. But he's very organized and very structured, and that comes across in this 200,000-word textbook that he wrote, you know, this manual for people. Whereas with Brian, I think his personality, and hopefully Andy's a bit as well, comes across in Unplugged. And I think that largely that's because the conversations with them drive the content. And I think, I wouldn't say that's the secret, because that makes it sound pretentious and lame, but that is one of the secrets.
Yeah. You mentioned the lower back injury, and you were doing stand-up paddle surfing. Are you familiar with Luke Longley?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Played for the Bulls.
Yeah.
He's an Aussie from Western Australia. TK and I were chatting with him a while back, and he's like a 7-footer, does stand-up paddleboarding, and he was looking for, I think at the time he wanted to start his own stand-up paddleboard, his league. Are you still, pardon for my not knowing this, but with the magazine, is that still up and running?
Oh yeah, heck yes.
Because I used to
Yeah.
I used to live in Long Beach, California, and I owned two of them, and it was a very good workout. When you were finding that it was helping your back, what did you ever sit down with that and like research what it was actually doing? Was it just being vertical? Was it using muscles around the injury that was allowing you to recover? What was that all about?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it was Kelly's just pure mobility work, not targeting stand-up, that helped me get over the hump of getting rid of that nerve pain. Okay. But then from there, I think that I wasn't doing a lot of rotation work, I found, in the gym. You know, occasionally you do some, like, twisting medicine ball tosses, right? Going back to the old strength and conditioning coach days when I played college soccer and basketball. But outside of that, or doing some, like, plate chops or something like that, wood choppers, I just wasn't doing very much rotation. So I think that was part of it. Mm. Partly was just crappy deadlift technique. I mean, as recently as a year and a half ago when I went up to see Kelly, he just broke my technique down to dust and rebuilt it from the ground up. So it was crappy technique. Yeah. But yeah, I think the rotation in stand-up paddleboarding certainly. And then there's a big difference between being crammed into, I mean, we all sit too much, right? And so sitting even more in, say, a canoe or a kayak versus being in a standing position, and if you have the basic technique down, that then having that platform to be able to generate and sustain power, and also to resist, not just generate power, but resist the feedback from the water in various conditions. And it's always changing as well. Even if you're on, you know, I'm landlocked in Colorado, but on our lake, you can go out one day and it's glassy, and then suddenly this, you turn around and head back up toward the lake house, and it starts blowing a gale in your face, and it changes the game. So let alone on the ocean, it's constantly changing. And so I think that challenge, and everyone's dynamic balance sucks, really. So the dynamic balance, the being able to generate power through rotation, is definitely definitely good. I mean, it's not very efficient. I mean, Kelly always says that, like, people say it's a good workout, and he says it's a shitty workout because your center of gravity is so high and you're bleeding so much force because of your relationship to the water versus, you know, a seated craft where a lot more of what you're putting into the oar or the paddle is actually resulting in power generated to the water. But it gives you a different vantage point. You are standing. And yeah, for me, that rotation has really helped over the years, for sure.
Yeah, Phil, with, you know, your last few books being so successful between both health and fitness and also sports, is that kind of where you're going to continue to niche going forward? Is that kind of the key to success for you, like staying away? So, for example, you don't write children's book, or did you write children's book before? Is that kind of, how do you find that kind of path?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is before Kelly and I wrote Waterman 2.0 and wrote Flight Plan, is my previous books were actually history books. So I wrote a microcosm history called Our Supreme Task, about how on earth Winston Churchill ended up in this tiny little town in the Midwest and the Iron Curtain speech he gave there. Yeah. And then Harry Truman was involved in bringing him over. And so I became quite interested in how Truman managed to survive a double split in the Democratic Party and a supposed Republican dream ticket on the other side and still win the 1948 election. And so I ended up writing a book about that. And so, yeah, I mean, I still really like to read history, more, and particularly little slices of life, little microcosm histories more than anything. And so, yeah, there's probably a Teddy Roosevelt book in me somewhere. I don't know, but
yeah,
right now it just with Kelly and I talking about our third book, starting to do more with Brian McKenzie as well, and Fergus, and you know, these are really great guys. They have transformative ideas, and I want to continue teaming with them. So I think the history stuff's probably 10-15 years out, and hopefully we could do some good co-authoring projects with these other guys in the meantime.
Yeah, when we were off air before we got you on, Tris and I were talking about how you know, yourself, McKenzie, Galpin, you know, Fergus, with like social media being, it's bigger and bigger, it's not going anywhere. And you have in our space, health and wellness, you have these just expert, you know, fitness professionals who pretty much come out of the woodwork, 21 years old, no education, huge following, and they're an expert and pseudo expert. And the message you guys are sending across, specifically like with Unplugged and not needing to attach, whether it's a fulfillment emotion or a success emotion to a following, If that wasn't something you firmly believed in, would you have taken part in that project when you were asked to take part in the Unplug?
No, not at all. I mean, it comes back to what Basher, you know, Don Cheadle's character says in Ocean's 11. It'll be good to work with proper villains again. You know, like, these guys are true experts in their craft. And there's a difference. Andy recently, I can't remember if it was on your podcast or another one, was talking about the difference between authorities and experts. So self-proclaimed authorities are the guys and girls that look really good in Instagram selfies and have massive followings and are paid 10 grand to do a tweet in the mirror, you know, show a little hip or whatever with their protein powder.
Yeah.
Those are self-proclaimed authorities.
Yeah.
There's a big difference between that and experts, like these, the guys we mentioned, like Gray Cook, like Dan John, like Pavel on the kettlebell side, the people that really legitimately know their stuff. But I mean, to me, you know, I remember with Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Body, you know, Gray's in there, done some stuff with Gray, Kelly's in there, Brian is in there, and really Tim is a seeker. And all the biohacking stuff aside, it goes beyond that. And so the privilege for me to be able to collaborate with this list, basically like 3 out of the 4 main experts in a book like that, that's a real blessing right there, and I feel very thankful to be in that position.
Absolutely. Hey, you know, with the short, I know you've got a mix. Is that intentional? Like, you do your magazine work and then you've got your book work. Is that kind of intentional to just keep you not sane, but kind of keep it all together, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's partly practical from a revenue standpoint. My wife is my secret weapon. She's my in-house editor, so she's the only reason any of this stuff is vaguely coherent, frankly.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when your royalty checks only come in, like, once every 6 months, then, and you have a wife and 2 kids, you know, then it's hard to keep the lights on with that, no matter what the size of those checks might be. And so, yeah, really, the other stuff is a good challenge in terms of output and being able to encapsulate ideas in, say, 800 or 1,000 words. But it's also just practicality of keeping the proverbial wolf in the door.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned royalties. In terms of, because, you know, you guys get published by some big publishing houses. Once you do one book, is it kind of you want to do a self-publishing route, or do you continue to with the same publisher?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, mate, and I've seen it from all sides. So I haven't personally done the self-publishing thing, but I know with Brett Bartholomew's Conscious Coaching, he went that route, and that turned out to be an excellent book. And I think Tim Ferriss has done all of the above in his continual self-experimentation. And so with us, yeah, I mean, I'll publish a victory belt if you look at, you know, all the people we just mentioned, and then people like Carl Powley, Jill Miller. I mean, it's kind of like a who's who on that roster, and Rob Wolf's first couple of paleo books as well. And so, but then you look at people also like Mark Sisson and what he's been able to do with Primal Publishing, where it started off because traditional publishers, and I'm probably going to shoot myself in the foot with this, are typically very, we're just going to say it, we'll be honest,
yes,
are typically they're in the risk management game. And they are typically very conservative. And I'm not talking about politically, because I don't care about politics, but I'm talking about they don't want to take risks. They want things that are derivative of something that's popular, like the new Hunger Games or the new Twilight or whatever the heck it is. And so that's when we start to get Divergent and all these knockoff series. Or they want to put all their money in the John Grisham basket or the J.K. Rowling basket because it's a proven entity. And really, if they're giving you money up front, it is the minimum amount they think you will accept. And then they're trying to structure that in such a way that you'll find it hard to see another penny.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Victory Belt doesn't give us anything up front, which probably isn't great for the old cash flow, but your royalties on the back end are uncapped and unlimited. So basically every book we sell, we get X amount, right? And so that means you do have to sell quite a few. But again, it means that you're uncapped, and it's a fairer way to do it. And that's partly because the founder and CEO, Erich Krauss, was an author and dealt with the traditional, like, big New York publishing houses for many years, and basically tried to do what Dyson did with the vacuum cleaner. He'd seen inside the belly of the beast, and he tried to find everything that was wrong with it and fix it. And then that gives us the platform to do what we do. So can self-publishing be done and done well? Yeah, it sure can. But for us right now, this is a pretty good fit for where we're at.
For some advice for myself, Tris, and anybody else listening, from a publishing perspective in terms of step by step. So say I have the table of contents done. I have all the content, actually. I have the chapters. I have my book.
Sure.
Don't have a publisher. Where would you go with that if you were in my shoes, the next step?
Well, in terms of the performance space, I would go to someone like Victory Belt, who is a specialty publisher in that area. And I would write a 2 to 3 page mini proposal, which I can email you the template that I've used, know what they want. And that's another difference with a big publishing house. They basically want half the bloody book. They want a big, big proposal. And so you can go ahead and do that, and then it doesn't happen. So do that. I mean, you could try to contact literary agents, and they would want you to write a bloody big proposal, and they would try to go and snare some publishers for you. And then they would take 15% of any deal you made, both on the upfront advance and then on the royalties on the back end. So that is the more traditional publishing route. And then if you exhaust both those possibilities, then just self-publish it through Amazon and do an audiobook version via ACX, which is a division of Audible, which is obviously a division of Amazon. But if you look, there's just a few requirements for audio quality on there, which you probably meet with your podcast anyway. So, the self-publishing is a good fallback that allows people to get their voice out and make it be heard.
Yeah, Phil, once you're actually done with your first draft, in terms of testing whether what you've written is really good, who do you turn to give you advice?
My wife. I mean, she's the in-house developmental editor, and so she'll say, nope, chapter 4 sucks, or...
So she rips you pretty hard.
She's like Steve Jobs.
Oh, yeah, hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, or it's, chapters 7 and 9 need to swap places, and here's why. So it's everything from that until when I'm ready to send it to, say, Brian and Andy or to Fergus. Then she does a line edit, and there is blood all over that page. It's red pen. And so much so that if I'm feeling raw and tired, because my number one rule is I don't miss a deadline, and so in doing so, it involves some late nights. And so I'll say, like, can I please get a smiley face in the margins? There's just one. But the old ego is a little fragile. But if you can take it from your better half, anything an editor or a publisher throws at you is going to be easy. It's going to be cake now,
Is your wife American?
Yeah, she is, yeah.
Whereabouts is she from?
She's from a suburb of Kansas City. So, we lived there for a number of years, and now we've been out in Colorado for 3, and I wish we did it 10 years before we did. Because Kansas is real flat, as you know, and Colorado isn't.
Colorado's beautiful. I've been there. I've always been intrigued because of the Wizard of Oz.
Really, that's why you're
interested? Nah.
It's flat. It's the Dust Bowl. Yeah,
Come out to Colorado instead, mate. We'll have a couple of bevvies. It'll be good.
Yeah, Colorado's awesome. There. Kansas is the state, like, during the gold rush when all the eastern part of the United States were rushing out west. The people in Kansas are the ones who just didn't go. They just stopped and stayed. And there's a whole documentary on the Dust Bowl, what happened.
Tornadoes, right?
Tornadoes and then the economy crash and the depression. But, yeah, Colorado is a great choice on your part, Phil. You mentioned, though, about the relationship with your wife and what she has to play in the part of the editing. But talk about the relationship with you and the authors as well, like in the egos or that trust factor that takes place. When was the moment when you knew that, like, Andy and Brian, they had your full trust? And then was there ever any moments where you kind of were, like, going back and forth, not seeing eye to eye on things?
No, I mean, there's always there's always some disagreement on certain things, and part of it is just context, because I see it from one perspective, then my wife almost exclusively reads fiction. And so in terms of putting stuff in terms that a lay reader can understand, that's one of the reasons that she's so good at it. Andy is a muscle physiologist. He is a scientist. Brian is a coach, a practitioner who is in the trenches every day. So obviously there are these competing viewpoints in some ways, but I think that sometimes it's just terminology and that kind of thing, but there is no ego. I mean, Brian talks about having a white belt mentality, and that is true. And he has that even in the areas he knows most about. And he's also humble enough to go to people in the field that he knows know more than him and test himself on that, And be, as he always says, becomes his own experiment. And so I mean, from the first 2 minutes of my first conversation with him, it was like, heck yeah, this is a guy I want to work with. And then the same with Kelly, same with Fergus, same with all these guys. And if you, considering how much influence and sway they have, it's amazing how humble they all are. Yeah. And they also don't want to believe their own bullshit. So if you call them out on something and you say, now, all right, here's where you're starting out and here's where we're ending up, and this doesn't add up, or we're missing something in the middle, they're not going to just pull the, well, I'm the expert, piss off card. They're going to really examine their own thinking and try to simplify and clarify their own thinking, as Steve Jobs once said, you know, about the importance of simplicity. And so, yeah it's really amazing that they give me as much leeway as they do, frankly. I don't know why.
I also have to inquire about, you know, as humans, we're like species of assimilation. Do you ever find yourself, like, because of your relationship with Brian, do you ever find yourself like doing long endurance events, or like, you know, the effects of the people you're sharing space with wearing on you, and maybe share some great positive examples of that from your close circle?
Yeah, I mean, with Brian, I think the biggest win from a standpoint of a physical practice that I've had maybe ever is just because I like to write at night. Like, I'm just useless in the morning. You know, I do a lot of shorter writing pieces or setting up interviews and that, and billing clients, that kind of thing in the mornings, and then just start revving up, you know, as the day goes on. And I find it hard to come down at night. So Kelly introduced me to the pleasures of ZMA, you know, the supplement, zinc, magnesium, vitamin B6 at night to kind of chill out a little bit. But beyond that, and a couple of bevvies, maybe a couple of beers in the aforementioned stout, obviously. If it's not impervious to light, guys, I'm not drinking it. It's basically the rule. But anyway, silliness aside, Brian just said, well, are you doing any breath work at night to help them come down after you're writing? I'm like, no, you know? And so literally, he had me do, there's a free test on his website, powerspeedendurance.com, and if you go on that and you do an exhale retention test, which is, as it sounds like, do three normal inhale and exhales, and then how long can you hold the last exhale? And then it will spit you out a couple of different protocols. So one is cadence, more like kind of the box breathing, as most people would know it. So say like a 5 second inhale, 5 second hold, exhale, and then exhale, hold. So that's more, you know, in the mornings I would do something like that, but then even more so at night. So it spat out the first one, a 5 second inhale, and all of this is nose only, like nasal. 5 second inhale, a 15 second breath hold, and then a 10 second nasal exhale. And if I do that even for 5 minutes, my quality of sleep and duration of sleep is just night and day better. And part of why is it just slams you into parasympathetic recovery. And so people might think it sounds unrealistic to do 5 minutes of this and have it change your life, but it really does. And I find if I'm consistent with it, the difference is huge. And so sometimes I'll preface this. I don't have a barrel sauna like Brian has, and neither do I have an ice bath. But even a stinking hot bath and a cold shower probably gets you 60, 70% of the way. And then after that, then I'll do the breath work, maybe read for 20 minutes, and then go to bed at some unholy hour and get up at some unholy hour. But that's okay, right? Don't judge.
Yeah, you mentioned the one of the breath tests. I think you call it retentive breathing. I actually did the one with you take 30 deep breaths, like real deep, and then softly exhale out. And on the 30th, you hold your breath. Did you do that one?
Well, that's kind of a variation of Wim Hof or superventilation, you know? And so that's kind of a different deal. So this one is just literally three slow nasal inhales and exhales. And then on that last exhale, see how long you can take to finish it. And so, and what's really surprising is some really high-level athletes have taken this thing, and their scores are just terrible compared to general population. And the reason is that CO2 tolerance is highly related to autonomic nervous system tone. And whether you are sympathetic dominant, highly stressed out all the time, which a lot of us are, or whether you are more chill, parasympathetic dominant, and you find it easier to relax and wind down and be in a true recovery state. And you're never fully one or the other, okay? Like, it's always a seesaw. But, yeah, this is, And the work that Brian's doing with Dr. Andrew Huberman, who you guys should have on, he's a brilliant mind from Stanford. On the clinical side, he has this fear lab where they have virtual reality, you know, with whatever people are scared of, heights. For me, it would be sharks, spiders. Yeah. And then they take various measurements. And really what they're finding is that there are certain things that are levers and knobs to control your state, whether that be physiological, you know, bodily state, cognitive, emotional. And one of the most powerful and most easily deployed knobs or levers is breath. There are breathing patterns associated with a flow state, you know, some of the Stephen Kotler stuff, with a chilled state. And sometimes we can get stuck in patterns that are not conducive to the results we want. And so really what Brian's starting to do with Andrew and others is come up with a breathing fingerprint, if you will, because much like nutrition or training stimuli, everyone's an individual. So we can have generic prescriptions. Like I can say, okay, well, I go and do this 5-second inhale, 15-second hold, 10-second exhale. Well, for me, that produces a certain result and gets me into a chilled out state where I'm ready for sleep. For you, it might rev you up for some reason. And so really just trying to go to the heart of this thing and be able to do a few simple tests and then give a personalized prescription around breathing and either the state that you want to be in or sometimes a negative breathing pattern that won't get you where you need to be and how to break out of that and get to where you need to be. I mean, this is the next frontier of performance.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, www.divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show.
Hey, Phil, Unplugged. The Phil before Unplugged, how attached were you with your technology, your social media? And then once you finish the book, tell us the difference between the Phil that came out of that.
Yeah, I mean, if it wasn't for vainglorious self-promotion, I wouldn't even mess with social media at all. And to me, most of the time I'm trying to big up my co-authors, you know, like, oh, check out this interview you guys did with Andy.
That's like all your posts.
You know, whatever it might be, like the books, right? It's kind of the sub mentality. But even outside of that, I just don't know. I was talking to my good friend Kenny Kane, who owns CrossFit LA and is Andy's co-host with Josh Embry on the Body of Knowledge podcast. Mm. And he said, mate, you know, when I, anytime I finish posting and then I inevitably get sucked down the rabbit hole for 5 or 10 minutes, yeah, and I'm looking at stuff. And he said, even if the links are beneficial and I'll do a bit of research, and he feels like crap afterwards. Yeah. And we were just talking about why is that? So, you know, there's something about it. And so, I mean, really, with the following that these guys have and my lack of need to promote myself, because I have more than enough opportunity within this realm now and within this circle of close friends, you should probably challenge me and say, well, you're not practicing what you preach. Get the heck off, you know? And so, yeah, I'm worse before, and it's partly because I maintain the social media accounts for Game Changer and for Unplugged, and that's my excuse. I was never on Instagram before Unplugged or Game Changer came out. And I'm sure I'm not moving the needle with my 3.5 followers, half being my wife, you know. I just don't see the validity in it. Whereas, you know, Kelly has 120,000, or Brian has 40,000, Andy has 20. So why the hell, I'll just make them do it and get off. But yeah, I mean, from a training, maybe I'll make that my New Year's resolution, try to stick to it. But beyond that, I think there were some training fallacies that I had, and one of them was the dreaded Concept 2 rowing machine, right? Probably the best piece of fitness kit I've ever bought. Got it for $250 on Craigslist. The guy that had used it 6 times and was moving to Texas to be near his grandkids. I didn't even hack him. I was like, I feel like I should have given him $450, you know? So bought this thing probably 10 years ago. And when the lake is going to freeze up here in Colorado pretty soon, we had snow yesterday. And so I'm on my last few paddling days and I'm panicked. But when the lake is frozen in the winter and won't unfreeze until April, you know, I get on the back on the concept too. And I used to have, I created this fallacy in my mind that I could not get through a hard interval workout without having a certain playlist plugged in, my headphones, without checking the monitor every 5 seconds, look at my 500 meter pace time, you know, this kind of thing. And also without having fueled, you know, 30 to 45 minutes before, you know, the old handful of almonds and a banana and apple. And I just created this thing. And if I didn't manage to get that snack, I would just tell myself, oh, it's going to be a crappy workout. Or yeah. If the battery ran out on my old first-gen iPod, you know, I still love the ClickWheel. It's awesome, isn't it? But, you know, that I would, that the workout results would be terrible or less than optimal. And so, you know, the guys just challenged me to examine that and to play around with it. And what I found was that the old big D-sized batteries, I think they are, and the Concept 2 ran out, so I just didn't replace them. And even before that, I started putting the monitor face down, you know, or rotate. And I started trying it without having eaten since lunchtime. Say I would get back from my afternoon writing session at the coffee shop, which is a good 30-minute walk each way. And then I would just go and row at, you know, 6 o'clock. So I hadn't eaten in maybe 6 hours. And that isn't a super long time. It's not like, say, oh, I was in ketosis, because obviously I wasn't. But, you know, for me, that's a lot different than having a snack at 5, 5.15 and then rowing at 6. And what I found was I did the session just to get the feel of what the exertion was like. And then I had a mate time me on my interval sessions, and then on a longer 5K. And I found I was really close. And there's also an example in Unplugged where Andy had a group of cross-country runners come in and run an 8K with no technology, not even a wristwatch, and record the time. And then they were asked to come in and repeat it a few days later. And with just the only guidance of, see if you can do this the same with the same level of effort as you did the first time. And all of them were plus minus 2 seconds or less over that distance, just on intuition. And that tells you something. So I learned something, and then when Andy shared that, I was like, holy crap. We all have the ability and the intuition to self-pace, to gauge our exertion. And sure, you can use heart rate monitoring, or you can use your 500 split toe, do the great thing with Concept 2 if you're trying to set a PR, right, or PB, row against yourself, right? I love that pace boat. Touch it, come on. Yeah. But not to say these things aren't useful, but these two examples really showed me that we all have this ability within ourselves, but we dull it through the use of technology. And by allowing marketing for these products to tell us that we need this coach, yeah, coach on the wrist, coach in the ear, coach through the app, personalized coaching on the go.
And then
not buying it.
I agree, because it also, you know, TK and I are both coaches as well in the trenches, and it also creates this mindset of, for the consumer, of a disconnect with our own intuition. And I think that has carryover effects outside of the gym or outside of the event that you're tracking on these devices. When you sent us through a couple weeks ago, maybe it's been a couple months now, the Unplugged book in the PDF form, Tristan breezed through it. I was going through it. At the same time, I was reading Aldous Huxley's A Brave New World that he wrote.
Frank Merritt, my co-author on 17 Hour Fast, not the blog, that book, but he said, he was like, it? Man,
dude,
you got to read this thing. And it blew my mind.
Yeah, man. He predicted, dude, Huxley, ridiculous, over 100 years ago he saw this coming. And then and then you guys are almost like, with Unplugged, it's almost like connected with the same thought process. But where we are in technology, it's like, for instance, I have one phone recording this as a backup, I have another phone with my work emails. It's like my baby. I can't leave the room, or I can't leave anywhere without like this relationship, yeah, with technology. Where do you think this is going to be at in 100 years?
Worse.
I know. We're going to be the phone. Like, it's going to be like this fusion.
This is not right. And this is not to say, like, anyone that hasn't read the book, this, Brian would smack me over the head if I didn't say this, and he would win that fight because he does all the jujitsu stuff. But he's pretty intense. He's awesome. But yeah, so I would be remiss if I said that this is an anti-technology book, but because it isn't. It is a book about boundaries. Okay.
I like it.
And it is also a book about intentions and being intentional. And so I think, you know, one of the books that really influenced me is Adam Alter's Irresistible. And forgive me if you ever heard any of my other interviews, I mentioned this damn book, and Adam isn't paying me to, I just really like the book. And so he says in that the average American adult looks at or touches their phone every 6.5 minutes.
Unbelievable.
If you don't think that is a problem and you don't think that is a hallmark of addiction, you are kidding yourself.
Yes.
And then you add in, now I have this device on my wrist, and I even have it on me at night because it's supposedly monitoring my sleep. And there's some stuff in the book about that, right? Like if your sleep score doesn't correlate with how you're feeling, it's wrong. Your feeling isn't wrong.
Yeah,
but anyway, that aside, so we're layering on more addiction. We're making ourselves real twitchy. I don't know if you guys remember in South Park the character Tweak, you know, the kid who's, I think his parents own a coffee shop or something, and he's constantly twitching, and it's supposedly because of the caffeine. Well, now we're all like that because of our damn phones.
So true, man.
And now even, I mean, I posted something the other day which wasn't necessarily that profound because I'm really not that conceited, but the new iPhone, if you buy it outright, costs $999.
$1,500.
And the cost of giving one child clean water for life in Liberia through this charity, The Last Well, that I do some writing for pro bono, is $20.
We had just
there's a disconnect on here. And I'm not saying that one of these things is like the other and that, you know, we all know we should give more, but it's pretty simple. If you bought a $400 phone and you gave the $600 away to something like that or whatever cause you're passionate about, then we could all change the world. If you bought something $20 less and gave that away. So it's an arms race of cost as well. Or you see these guys in Colorado, you know, Boulder is like the Lycra capital of the world because of the triathletes and the endurance cyclists. And it's a cool town, but it just, there are these guys that, you know, have bikes you can almost lift up with your pinky finger, but then their mate gets one that's 32 grams lighter, and the whole club was
keeping
envious, and you've got to get, or even paddleboarding.
Yeah.
Oh, we got one now that's, you know, the glide is way better. Well, I'm going to go out and drop $2,200 on this. Or, you know, the new Nikes, like if you customize them, they're like $280. And it's like, dude, like remember the old Michael Jordan campaign with Mars Blackmon, you know, Spike Lee? It's got to be the shoes, Mike. Is it the shoes? If you really think that Michael Jordan could only dunk a ball from the free throw line because of his Air Jordans, you might want to, as Led Hamilton says, you might want to go and sit under a tree for a while and do some thinking. Okay? The technology is not what's making you better, and it's not what makes the elite the elite.
Yeah.
It's the work ethic.
Yeah.
It's the great coaching. It's the
persistence,
the stick-to-itiveness, you know. It's the freaky genetics if you're a Usain Bolt or a LeBron James, but it sure as heck isn't the technology. And even someone recommended to me today to watch this documentary on the 2-hour project, you know, with Nike and Adidas in this arms race to get a marathon runner under 2 hours. Well, they have to do it on like a Formula One track, you know. They got pacemakers running in front of them so that the aerodynamics are better. And the guy still couldn't break the bloody record. And, you know, supposedly these new shoes are 3% more efficient. But we get obsessed with the marginal gains of the pros, okay? Say if you were missing 30% of your hip extension. Well, even if you got the shoes on and they did make you 3% more efficient, which I'm not buying, and you guys probably aren't anyway in terms of purchasing or indeed buying into it. Well, what if you did Kelly Starrett's couch stretch on each leg 5 minutes a day, every time you finished a workout, and you gain back half that missing range. You gain back 15% hip range of motion. And then the knock-on effect for what that did for your performance, well, that's a lot bigger gain than those shoes just gave you. Okay, well, now let's look at your ankle, and let's say you're missing 20%, I don't know, flexion or dorsiflexion, okay, at the foot and ankle. Okay, well, say you do a couple of exercises on your ankle for a couple of minutes a day, you gain back half of that. You just gained yourself 10%, okay?
Yeah.
And it's so really what the point being that we're obsessing over these little speed bumps, which clever ad campaigns are telling us are in our way, but we've made the minors the majors. We're missing the major potholes and the sinkholes that we're falling down, nutrition, breathing,
rest,
sleep,
recovery,
hydration.
100%. You're actually making me really laugh in my own head because some of my own friends that have just joined the gym, the first thing they buy are compression garments. And the thing with compression garments, they work for high-level athletes, in my opinion, because I've tried them before, and they give you a little edge.
You're talking about compression shorts?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I got them on now.
So, for example, you know, they've never been in the gym before, and I go to them, like, for example, compression garments are going to give you a 1% or 2% edge from things that you do. I go to them.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
If it.
If anything, yeah. Maybe it's a placebo.
And I go, the biggest thing you guys can do, I'll give you a 50% increase. Just turn up.
Yeah. It's.
Yeah.
It's the biggest thing.
That's the biggest thing. It's just like this. And you just spoke
about getting
this.
And sleep. What you're talking about, yeah, what you're talking about with turn up, mate, is mastery. The pursuit of mastery. And what I love about martial arts, you know, one of my other goals of 2018 is to make myself start doing this because I never have, is, or even how Pavel approaches kettlebells, like Simple and Sinister is one of the greatest health and fitness books of all time, because he rightly says, if every day, if all you did was a few kettlebell swings and a few get-ups, and you continually refined your technique, and you worked on power, you changed the weights up, you changed the reps up, and you did this even 3 or 4 days a week. When your mate asks you to come move house because he knows you're strong and you look strong, it's because you are, and you're going to be fine with moving that piano and that bloody washer and dryer up and downstairs. You'll be, you know, you when you're older, you'll be able to play with your grandkids, okay, with full range of motion, if you just did these things. And so what you're talking about and showing up is a daily discipline, which is the true path to mastery. So, and that's what all these hacks are missing. And that's the problem with technology, is we think that this technological hack, this coach, you know, coach on the wrist, coach in the ear, is going to be a shortcut, much like the entire premise of the weight loss industry. Well, if I drink this powder, I'm going to lose 30 pounds in 30 days, right? These things may happen, but they're not healthy and they're not sustainable. So I like what you said, because what you're talking about really there is it are the steps to daily discipline, which is the only path to mastery. As Jocko Willink says in Discipline Equals Freedom, his new book, there is no shortcut, right? You just, you show up and you do the work.
And you
also, you have to, you know, daily discipline implies being a disciple of someone. And, you know, whether or not you believe that the Bible is true or not, that means having a master whose discipline you submit to, or just seeking out someone that you recognize it and are humble enough to acknowledge knows more than you and learning from them. And that's like the whole sensei concept, right? In, well, whether it be the Karate Kid or just, you know, martial arts in general. And so, yeah, that really appeals to me. And that's something I'm going to want to explore more in my personal life, because I want that kind of discipline in my life. And even outside of the breath work and whatever other daily disciplines I have, I think that that, from a martial arts standpoint, would be really additive.
Yeah, Dave Thomas, the former founder, millionaire of Wendy's Hamburgers, before he passed away, he was doing this interview and he was asked, Dave, why are your hamburgers square? And he said, to remind my customers and my workers that we don't cut corners. It's an everyday reminder that there are no shortcuts. And I think it's a good, you know, what you're talking about, even with people wanting that extra edge but not wanting to work for it. I think we live in a culture of impulsive, you know, decision making and things right now, put food in the microwave, you know, all that sort of thing. And there's no secret to the sauce. It's showing up and being, you know, adherence is huge, you know, staying focused and disciplined.
I mean, adherence is everything. And what you find from something like the daily breath work, okay, you do get an acute benefit. So say tomorrow night, right, I'm working till 2 a.m. On a book, whatever I might be doing, and I do the breath work. Well, it has an acute on-the-spot benefit. Within 5 to 10 minutes, I can feel myself relax and I'm going to sleep better. But then there are also accumulated benefits. My resting heart rate is now 7 or 8 beats lower when I started this daily breath work. And frankly, I'm not even doing the cadence work in the morning more than two or three days a week. But it's this accumulated benefit. And there are these just your general overall inflammation markers. Like if I had been smart enough to do the blood work before and after, I really believe there would have been some measurable physiological effects. Yeah. And just things, just general, like perceived rate of overall stress in your life, this kind of thing. And that's what you can only get with mastery, is the acute on-the-spot benefits that an in-quotes hack might give you, but then the accumulated benefits over time, over a lifetime.
That's right, man.
All right, Phil, let's finish on Game Changer, because I'm pretty much finished the book, and you guys gave so much away in that book, but you can kind of see that between Game Changer and Unplugged, well, Unplugged, I think that anyone can read, because it's like a general pop thing, while Game Changer is kind of more niched. It's more towards the strength and conditioning coach or someone involved in sports that might want to learn more about the insights on creating a team and developing a team. In terms of the response that you're getting from people, are you surprised maybe about the amount of people in the strength and conditioning industry that both follow Fergus and yourself and also just interested in the actual topic?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that even for the casual fan, like for me now, when I'm watching an NBA game, I'm starting to think about width and depth and ball speed and man speed. And I was reading a great article. I'll send it to you guys. I believe it was in the latest ESPN, The Mag. It's got the beard on the front with CP3, and it's good. And I love the NBA. That's the only reason I'm in the US is because I love basketball. I wanted to play college basketball, and I wasn't good enough to play Division I, but I did play a little NAIA. And anyway,
where'd you go?
Kind of a personal connection there, but that aside, this article, it talks about how Steve Kerr and his main assistant walked into a wine bar in an airport, right? They were getting ready to fly back right after he'd been hired. Mm. And there was this guy in the kitchen working that was a huge Warriors fan, going back to like the glory days of Run TMC, right?
Chris Mullin.
And he came out and talked to him, and he said he didn't, you know, it says he was kind of nervous, and he thought, I'm just going to speak up. And he said to Steve Kerr, like, how are you going to play? Are you guys going to play the right way and pass the ball more and, you know, be high octane like we used to be with Chris Mullin and Tim Hardaway and Mitch Richmond, Run TMC glory days?
Oh, yeah.
And he was like, well, let me show you. You know, I've been thinking about these ideas for a while. Let me show you. And literally on a meat and cheese board, he starts showing the guy, this is how the triangle works. And then this is how Steve Nash and co did it in Phoenix. And what I want to create is this hybrid. So here's Almond Steph Curry, right? And here's like cranberry Klay Thompson. And here's how I think they can screen down for each other and do this. Literally showed him the entire offense that they obviously won two championships with now and probably win a third this year. And kind of taking the Spurs concept of ball movement to just another level. And so I think that even the way I watched the game and some of the quotes from Steve Kerr about man movement and ball movement and how the only metric they cared about, all of the sports science crap, all the millions of dollars, they came up with one. And it was they wanted 300 passes per game. That's all they wanted. And Fergus, man, this is right down with what he has to say. Like, the numbers are not meaningless, but you've got to understand how do they fit into the context of the coach's philosophy? And ultimately, how are they going to affect the scoreboard? And so if you can hone in on one or two things that enables one better outcomes or you to ask better questions, that's worthwhile.
Yeah.
If you're just interested in putting in 3D motion capture cameras in your weight room that cost, you know, $75,000, or you need some expert on site to interpret this stuff, and you've got a team of 12 statisticians and all these numbers, you know, and even in commentary, you hear it like in a game, like, well, LeBron's gone 6 minutes and 16 seconds without a field goal attempt. And I kind of pause and I'm like, what's your point? You know, like they're just trying to fill dead space, whereas Marv Albert or one of the great old-style commentators, you know, would just, or even some of the great old-style coaching commentators like Hubie Brown, they would make observations about the game and then just shut the heck up and let the game be enough. But now they've got these people piping these meaningless numbers in. And so really what Fergus is trying to do is create context, okay? The cultural organization of your team matters. How you have your headquarters set up from an ergonomic standpoint matters, okay? Certain numbers may matter, but not if they aren't in the context of quality and of outcome.
Yeah.
And I think in team sports particularly, you know, we saw it in rugby and in probably in Aussie rules with like the GPS, right, the track how far the guys run in training, or even I remember watching the Champions League and they would try to say, oh, well, so-and-so is by far the hardest working player on the pitch because he ran all these meters. Well, if you've stood at the center circle and you just ran around it the entire game, you would rack up the most meters, but you would have zero effect on the game. So it just goes to show it, those stats are largely meaningless. And the correlations we try to make between, say, distance covered or whatever it might be in a game, and then try to extrapolate that to work ethic or whatever, that's too much of a leap. And so really, Fergus has come up with a series of principles that distills the game down to their essence in any team sport. And he also he also tries to go beyond the physical, because almost every problem that manifests itself on game day, people try to say it's physical. Oh, they're just not strong enough, so let's have them do more squats or deadlifts, you know? See it in the NFL combine, right? Like, there's even some stat that shows how much more a 0.1 second in the 40-yard dash is worth in terms of dollars for a player entering the draft. And they've also then laid over that their career trajectory and whether it correlates, and it does not correlate at all. And so really what he talks about, his four collective model, it, physical is one, but technical, tactical, and psychological elements also come into play. Because Messi is not the best footballer in the world because of physical attributes. Okay?
Of course not.
Tom Brady is not arguably the greatest quarterback of all time because of physical attributes. It's technical acumen.
Systems.
It's knowing the tactics of the team and being able to execute them. It's the psychological strength to be down 30 or 40 points in the Super Bowl and will your team back to victory. These, what some people call the intangibles.
Well, systems too, though. Like, you take Brady when he came out of Michigan and he went to New England, and Michael Vick coming out of V-Tech went to Atlanta and he played in that system. Brady only succeeded in New England and still succeeds because of the offense and the system that Belichick has created as the puppet master. But if you put Brady in a run and gun, or like, you know, to force it, it's just a system thing as well.
It's interesting. If Tom Brady was at another club, do you think he would be as good as he was?
You can't test that, but he barely started. I'm an Ohio State fan, and you mentioned LeBron. I have to disagree with you about the Warriors again this year, because Cleveland will, if we can stay healthy, if we can stay, you're crazy, man.
Golden State, you're crazy.
You're Golden State soft,
man.
Golden State soft, but
Ben Simmons. Ben Simmons.
Get off the odds. He can't stay healthy. But the metaphor,
10-point guy.
The metaphor you use, or Fergus was using, reminded me, and people listening probably, of that terrible manager you had, maybe in a call center, micromanaging, and you said, rather than Kerr wanting, you know, I played basketball growing up too, rather than three passes a possession, he's looking at 300 passes in a game to get that overall outcome. It just reminds me of, like, you know, those bad managers who want you to call for that moment rather than, hey, did I hit my KPI for the month?
But what it's tied to, though, is philosophy. And when he was up, Kerr was asked, what is the one word you want to be associated with your club? And it was joy. He wants his team to play joyfully. To do so, they need to share.
Yeah.
And to do so, this article goes into how they need to go deep into the bench, even in the playoffs. Mm. Everyone has to touch the ball. Everyone has to get a chance to contribute. Yeah. And basically, he took the best of what Greg Popovich did in San Antonio, what Phil Jackson did, and then what Mike D'Antoni did. And he blended them into this hybrid offense.
Yeah.
And so it started with philosophy, from that word joy. Then that came, okay, how do we want to play? And then it came to what flaws did he see in how they were playing? Well, they were either dead last or second to last in total overall passes, okay? And very, very low on the game speed, you know, and how quickly it took. It was the opposite of the 7 seconds or less with Mike D'Antoni. Yeah. Okay, it's fun to play under control, but to play quickly and to move the ball and to create space. So, again, going back to Fergus's two of his fundamental principles, a man movement or woman movement, depending on which side of the game you're on, and ball movement, those create space. Space creates time. Time creates more ability to execute, okay? And then it all ties back to that core philosophy. And so what you were talking about in New England, American football is not my game, and I'll admit that straight away. But Belichick wants those guys to play a certain way. He has a philosophy.
Then he finds
the strategy to get them there. And then the strategy and the principles always stay the same.
Yeah.
And the game-to-game tactics might vary by opponent. But what it comes down to is the Warriors, whether they're playing the Cavs, the Spurs, your boy Simmons and the 76ers, they're going to play with joy. They're going to play quickly. And they're going to pass the ball.
Yeah.
And they have the personnel to do that.
Yeah.
And so I think really it comes back to that core philosophy, and then everything else stacks up underneath that.
Philosophy is important.
You know, Belichick's got the leanest staff in the NFL.
Like,
he's got the least coaches out of every single club.
He's a tyrant. Belichick came from Cleveland. He's a tyrant. He breaks the rules.
It's interesting. Really
but, back to the philosophy, too. Basketball is your sport. Think about, like, a program collegiately. You have, like, Coach K running in Duke. He never recruits, like, five-star one-and-done guys like Calipari. You know, you have different programs. Like, Calipari will recruit these studs, these five-star guys probably going in there for 1 year and moving on, while Coach K takes the kid that he sees as an 18-year-old and he'll stay there for at least 3 to 4 years and mold them. And it works for each guy individually, and I guess it all comes down to figuring out that philosophy for the system. But, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And even just Fergus talks a little bit about culturally. If you are in a blue-collar town, you need to have a team that plays freaking hard, right? Like, think about the smash-mouth Ben Wallace defense with the Pistons, or even the Bad Boys before that. Look at Detroit. All right, let's go back to the run TMC Warriors before the current Warriors. The West Coast is a hotbed of innovation with Silicon Valley.
Hip-hop.
It's fast. It's, you know, there's tech incubators. You know, it's ahead of the game.
That's interesting.
They play the same, and this doesn't always hold, but you cannot rule out cultural influence and your locale and what impact that has, and also the kind of play that the fans want to see. Now, a coach can't just cater to what the fans want, because that would be chaos, but you do have to bear that in mind. Mm-hmm. And you also have to bear in mind the history and culture of your team. And so, you know, same with Liverpool, like their "This is Anfield" sign that they have up. Well, I'm not sure if they lived up to it recently, but that's meant to mean something. So even the venue where you play, the old Boston Garden, like outside of Red Auerbach, wanting to heat up the opponent's locker room or chill it down in the winter to mess with them, intimidate them, that is meant to mean something. Going into Old Trafford to play Man United is meant to be intimidating because it is Old Trafford. And it's not like the American Airlines Arena, you know, or something. I don't know.
You boys.
Phil, it's been an awesome chat. Yeah, man. I really appreciate you coming on, man. Like, you know, you gave some great insights.
We could have talked about each point. Like, I wanted to talk about the flow state and the breathing, but we covered a lot, man. We'll have to do this again.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah. We'll get Brian on here as well. With him in the mountains up in Oregon and me in the mountains in Colorado, you're bound to lose one of us at least halfway along the way.
At least mentally.
Been great. Phil, before we let you leave, if you want to follow Phil, he's online at philwhitebooks.com. Instagram, he's at philwhitebooks. Twitter, philwhitebooks. And now both Game Changer and Unplugged, I'm sure, on Amazon. We'll have the links for you all in the show notes anyway. Is that the best way for them to get it, Amazon, Phil?
Yeah, it is, mate. Yeah.
Definitely. We'll have those in the show notes. But Phil, thanks, my man. It's been awesome. It's been a good little triangle we've had with the different national
teams.
Yeah, you taught us a
lot. This is good, mate.
I'd love
to keep in contact. And, I'd love to talk about the 17-hour fast. That'll be out in March. It isn't up for pre-order on Australian Amazon yet, so I didn't want to go into it too much today, but I'll get on the horn with the publisher after I get off the show. I just realized that before I got on. And, I'd love to talk about that because my co-author there is, he is a legitimate doctor, not like a doctor of, I don't know, something stupid, an ology. So he's an emergency room physician down in Florida. He's board certified in internal medicine. And the motivation behind this book is his best mate got brain cancer in the most aggressive form. And he was given a max of 6 months to live. And so Frank and his colleagues at the hospital, some endocrinologists, behavioral psychologists, all the ologists you can imagine, all got together and said, how can we keep this guy alive and not just that quality of life? And so at the time of the diagnosis, this guy Jason had no kids. Well, him and his wife were able to have two kids. Wow. He practiced law almost to the end, and they kept him alive for 7.5 years.
Wow.
And part of that was this fasting protocol, the 17-hour fast, and just what it was able to do in stemming the spread of that. And so before he died, Jason made Frank promise that he would use what they had learned to help other people and really, you know, just get this out there to the mass market. And so this is the first step in doing that. And so, the backstory is pretty hardcore, but then this guy isn't effing around, and this is not some gimmicky biohacking fast book to sell supplements.
We'll get in touch when it's ready and definitely come back on the show and talk about it.
That hits home, both of us. Yeah, Tris and I both recently lost a friend to that exact thing, so Well, yeah, we're looking forward to that chat.
My wife's dad passed away about a year and a half before we met at the same kind of brain cancer that Frank had. And so, for us, when he told me this story, and he's actually, you know, you probably saw his name. He's featured pretty heavily in Unplugged. It was initially, you know, Brian's mate, and I met him through him. And so when he told us this, you know, it made my wife cry, number one, because of, you know, all the memories of seeing her dad sick. But it was like, man, you don't have to sell me on co-writing this thing with me, you know. It's just, let's just freaking get this done, because this information needs to be out there. So,
yeah, we're looking forward to it.
For sure. All right, Phil, have a great weekend.
All right, guys. Yeah, cheers, lads. Appreciate it.
We'll talk soon, buddy.
All right, bye for now. See you.
Johnny, Phil Watt, man.
That was awesome. We finally got to sit down with him, and it's becoming cooler more and more when we have the guest on, having already read their works, or they had sent them firsthand to us, and it just builds that instant camaraderie and gets a great chat like we just had just now.
Yeah, we'll stay in touch with Phil. You know, the end of the chat, the whole chat was brilliant, but, you know, we've obviously had a mate that died from brain cancer.
Yeah,
I've seen a couple that other people that have also, you know, unfortunately not survived as well. And
it's one of the most common, unfortunately, cancers in Australia. Did you know that is brain cancer?
And it's so aggressive.
It's so aggressive.
Like you said, it just like seems that the person's life is just changed upside down in a blink.
And it you know what, I was talking with a friend recently about, you know, our outlook as people on death, and how we're not raised to sit with death too much, and it's always shocking and saddening, and, you know, it's always a tragedy. But for however much at work I put in individually, because, you know, I've lost my father, I've lost good friends, and I like to tell myself over and over that I'm okay with it, but I don't know if anyone's ever okay. And it just hearing Phil give us that feedback at the end on that new body of work, what he's working on, I can't wait to read it, because we're watching a guy like Phil White totally keep one-upping on his career, like leveling up, taking it down a different road. And I think a lot of people could find value in all of his works, but I'm also looking forward to the one that he aforementioned.
Imagine that, you know, you had someone close to you that was diagnosed with that unfortunate disease, and if you can get 7.5 years
I mean,
instead of 6 months, it's just like, well, do everything you can. I mean, you get 2 kids out of it, you got a great career out of it.
I'm that's sure the silver
relationships
line.
Relationships kept flowing and flowing, but 7 and 2, that's a huge difference.
It's heavy, man. I know that you and I both have lost close people to us in the last year. And maybe, you know, anyone out there struggling with anything, man, or, you know, maybe you need to tie up some relationships, or you're fighting over really minute things, maybe give those people a call, because you never know when, you know, one of your buddies or your mother or, you know, somebody really close to you, you know, that happens to. And I think we become too petty on things quite often. We become too narcissistic on me. And then that, like, how many times have you guys gotten into a fight with a friend over nothing? And then you hold this grudge. And it's like, life's way too short for that, man.
Yeah, just practice gratitude. I've been talking to a lot of athletes lately about gratitude and things like that.
Yeah, it's huge, isn't it?
It's actually funny. I listened to a podcast yesterday. You know, Kellan Lutz, he was in that vampire, what's that called again?
I don't know.
You know that movie series, what's that called again?
Don't you dare.
Twilight.
How dare you? You knew that I would know it, but you know I didn't watch it. And now people think that I watched it.
You watched it.
I never seen it.
But it was amazing. And he was talking about how he found gratitude and just different things, and how he actually found his wife. This just was so intriguing to me, the fact that sometimes we go around in circles not even knowing what we want.
Or what we're doing.
So what he did when he found his wife, so literally, it just seems so simple, but maybe we all have to do it for us that are single. It's just like he wrote down on paper 6 or 7 qualities that he was looking for in a woman.
That's amazing.
And literally the month
later. Did you share the podcast with me? What's it called?
Yeah, it's James Altucher's show.
What's his last name?
James Altucher.
Altucher.
Yeah.
He's
a famous writer.
Very famous writer.
How about a great podcast as well.
What's it called?
Richard Prancer was on the James Altucher show.
Okay.
Yeah. But he was just sharing it. It's literally a month later. It's like the exact woman that he wanted. His wife was there.
It's a beautiful story.
And this was years and years after chasing around with just obviously the movie star, with women that just had no connection with or had no interest even being with. And it's just interesting that once he actually put down on paper exactly what he wanted, the person that he was looking for was finally found.
Yeah, and that's hugely important. I mean, the vision board, what we want. You mentioned before, you know, Callum, how many people are just going through the motions though with their life, whether it's their career or even their intimate relationships, just to be in one rather than have intention. There's an awesome philosophy called intention versus attention.
Yeah.
And it's like, we think on the surface it's the same thing, but it's totally different. having the intention of what you want to do or what you want to achieve or who you want to be in love with, these are important things, yeah, to write down. I'd never thought about doing that.
It's interesting,
yeah. Yeah, for a partner, for like a loved one, that is interesting.
That's kind of like got me thinking I'm going to probably do it, just to think that.
Just put it down there.
Well, maybe this is what I really want in life, you know what I mean? Someone that loves kids, just for
5'11", blonde, doesn't speak English, dime piece, athlete. What would your ideal woman be?
I don't know, yeah, I've got to actually have a good sit down and have a think about it, but...
I think a CrossFit type woman, an athlete.
You know what? I don't think I'd want a girl that trains as much as I do. I want someone that looks after themselves.
Yeah.
But not, like, I go to the gym probably 5 or 6 times a week, and that's 60 minutes max.
Yeah.
I don't think I want anyone that obsesses more than that, man.
Yeah. I don't like, I love, like, when I see the fit couples, maybe it's because I'm single and I'm bitter and I'm resentful. Yeah, maybe. But you know, when you see fit couples, you're like, ugh. They train together and they look happy. Really get that. How dare you?
Like, I think biggest thing I found over the last kind of 2 or 3 years is just that kind of – people say it's 80-20. I think it's more kind of like – yeah, you could probably say 80-20 over time. Maybe kind of 90-10, doing good things in terms of like feeding your body really well.
Okay.
To drinking alcohol, et cetera,
et cetera. That sweet spot, Ian, what the percentage is.
It's kind of like, I think everything fits in a way.
What would you say you are now, to be honest? Guys listening, Tristan and I, this is our passion. Like, we meet on these days usually around 5:30 in the morning on a Saturday morning after we've already worked 60, 70 hours Monday through Friday. And, you know, that puts us in this scenario Friday night. TK and I a lot of times don't go out, but but that's forced me and put me in a scenario that the 80-20 thing you're talking about, what once was before the vision board, maybe 60-40, 60 healthy, 40 unhealthy, has become almost like, I would say closer to like 90-10 right now for me. And I'm happy about it.
The thing I think is different now is that I can switch the flick anytime. I could go 100-0 very easy.
Yes, you're not missing anything. That's what it is. And Phil White, man, on his Instagram post, it was in my notes to bring it up, but he had a good point about on his Instagram. He wrote that when he unplugged from everything, his biggest worry was unplugged in the sense of detaching with, you know, referencing his book.
Yeah.
Was his one hesitation initially was that he was going to miss something. Mm. And I could relate when I was a kid. I always, like, in my teens and in my 20s, and I was the kid, the friend, always texting my boys, what's going on, who's partying? And I would always put myself in those party scenarios because I was looking for it because I think I was going to miss something. And now I find myself where I'm at in my career not sending those same text messages, and those certain people now aren't even in my life because I'm no longer reaching out to them, and it kind of shows me the strength of that relationship, and it really wasn't built on bricks. It was pretty much built on chaos. I think that's important to kind of understand, guys listening and girls, that equation.
Absolutely. I think I've been there before, worrying more about what other people were doing than myself. Now, if I'm sitting at home on a Friday night, I don't give a shit.
I don't either, man.
Good on you. This is what I'm doing.
Hell yeah.
I know what I'm doing, ring me, because I really don't care what you're doing.
That's right, TK. I'm loving it, man. That's a great point.
All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in. We're just getting our last couple of guests, scheduled for the next few weeks. Corey Peacock's meant to be coming back on, so he's meant to be on today. Unfortunately, he had a late appointment with a fighter. So we'll have him back on. Paul Rabel, he's the biggest lacrosse player in America. He's got a huge podcast, Suiting Up Podcast, where he interviews a lot of the famous NFL.
Transcending NBA, sports and business.
Sports and business.
Branding,
So he's doing huge stuff in America right now.
Can't wait to talk to that guy.
Yeah, I've been listening to his podcast pretty religiously.
You put me on to it.
It's a good show, so check it out if you haven't yet. So we've got some big ones coming up, a lot more strength and conditioning, guys. Hold on, I'll tell you our schedule while we're here, so then you can kind of get excited.
Anybody out there living in the Sydney, Australia area that want to do to work side by side with two savages to be our young Jamie, you hit us up at info@divisionboardpodcast.com. What if we had a young Jamie right now to be able to do all that stuff? Or like how they have Google on deck all the time? It had a dynamic.
What are you talking about?
Dude, trying to get a little PA in here. Sydney really media.
A little PA. So you're trying to say the, what you're always on.
The adjective. Hold on. How dare you?
Ultimate.
Tristan Cannell. How dare you?
Let's see if I can find a schedule. I maybe haven't seen one for a while.
Yeah, you got one. I just looked at it. I know we got Dr. Corey Peacock, Rabel coming on.
Derek Hansen.
Master John. Derek Hansen, speed specialist, guys.
Master John's coming back. Andrew Ma, he was in the army and that. So some good ones coming up, guys. So stay tuned. Tell your family and friends. Johnny, before we go, social media.
Guys, follow me all socials. It's easy. Johnny Stofko. Go to my YouTube channel. Got some new videos up there. I really appreciate the support. How about you, TK?
Tristan Cannell across all my social media. So please get in touch with myself and Jenny. Johnny, obviously, send an email, info@thevisionboardpodcast.com. Yeah, another fun one, brother.
That was so awesome.
You have a nice weekend, man.
You too, TK. I'm going to give you a hug off air.
No. Peace. There, guys.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching a niche, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working harder. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.